So first of all, I just wanted to start by asking, you've written about Joe Hart, and we know what's going on with him at Man City at the moment. Where do you see his future? Does he have a future at Man City under Pep Guardiola?
I don't think he does. I mean, Guardiola clearly doesn't rate him as the sort of goalkeeper he wants. I mean, the stories that they did a training drill where the ball was rolled to a goalkeeper on his left foot, and he was asked to knock it to his right foot and then sweep the ball out to the left wing. And Hart was actually quite good at the passing part of that, but moving the ball from one foot to the other, he was very cumbersome. And we were led to believe it's that led to Guardiola's doubts about him. So if those doubts are so profound that they prefer Willy Caballero for the first game of the season, then they appear to be in very significant talks, or, you know, the talks are quite well advanced to sign Claudio Bravo, then I don't really see how Hart can be a reserve at City if he wants to continue being the number one.
A point that was raised is that even with Joe Hart's sort of deficiencies with the ball at his feet, isn't he still a better short-term alternative than Willy Caballero until Pep Guardiola finds a more permanent goalkeeper?
In terms of shot stopping, you'd think so, but then, you know, he made those two high-profile errors in the summer. And Caballero's stats, it's very hard to compare, obviously, from one league to another, because part of the research I did for that piece was to compare the Premier League to the Bundesliga and La Liga. And what you see is all goalkeepers in the Premier League have worse pass completion stats than in the Bundesliga or La Liga, presumably because of the pace of the game and pressure to put on keepers. So it is quite hard to compare. But I think it is noticeable that on Saturday, Caballero had an 80% pass completion rate. Now, okay, that's against the Sunderland side, who essentially sat deep. They didn't put a huge amount of pressure on the City keeper. But still, the fact he could get as high as 80%, and I guess Guardiola's logic is that, okay, maybe Hart saves, I don't know, one shot out of 20 that Caballero can't, but actually the overall benefit of having a player who can move the ball quickly at the back, who can initiate attacks, is greater, even if Caballero's shot stopping is not as good as Hart's.
So what did you make of Guardiola's first competitive league game then against Sunderland?
I didn't think it was great, actually. I mean, I'm not saying they didn't deserve to win, because they clearly had far more chances and everything. But if it had been a draw, which it very nearly was, I don't think you'd have said it was a travesty. And, you know, you think of the goals they scored, they were absolutely gifted the penalty. I mean, a really stupid tackle from Patrick Van Aanholt, no need for that. Gives them a perfect start. And you sort of think, well, this is a Sunderland side who are probably a bit vulnerable. Quite a few players missing, to the extent that John O'Shea is having to play in midfield. We don't quite know what Lamine Kone's future is as to how committed he's going to be. So you sort of thought, well, you know, this could easily be 3-0 or 4-0, and that actually in itself wouldn't have told us much. But then City barely created anything, and then a little bit of sloppiness to concede the goal. And Jermaine Defoe had one other good chance as well. So, I mean, it's early days, yeah, but it all seemed a little bit mannered. And the way they played with the two fullbacks pushing into midfield, so you sort of, when City had the ball, the shape was sort of a 2-1-2-5. I know he's played like that at Bayern, and I know that will take time for players to get used to. But I'm not really sure the fullbacks they've got there, the Clichy and Sanya, are good enough on the ball to play like that. And you think at Bayern, when you have Philipp Lahm and David Alaba, obviously they're players who are extremely comfortable on the ball. So I'm not sure that's going to work. But, yeah, they got the win. I don't think anybody played particularly well in the first weekend of the season, and we'll see how that goes. But there was something a little bit laboured, a little bit mannered about it, I thought.
And looking at their opponent, Sunderland, what are you expecting from them this season under David Moyes?
Well, I guess the first thing is to win a game in August, which they haven't done for 6 years now. I think there was a realistic expectation they would buckle having conceded the stupid early penalty. I think they can be pretty happy with how they played. I think a lot of sides will get battered at City this season, and to get to within 3 or 4 minutes of getting a point, and yeah, to concede a goal that really is unlucky, that, you know, cross driven across, your keeper gets a hand that hits Paddy McNair and goes in. I guess there's encouraging signs, but yes, Sunderland seem to be locked in this endless cycle of every time they get a manager who looks like the players are responding to him, something goes wrong, and the manager leaves for one reason or another. And I think they were, I mean, I'm not really sure how this could have been done better, but I think Sunderland were a little bit let down by the whole process that led to Sam Allardyce becoming England manager, that David Moyes came in I mean, actually, they got the deal done pretty quickly. I don't really think you can blame the club for that. But, you know, it was, just over a week before the start of the season. So in terms of bringing in new players, not a lot of time to look at people. And I guess in that regard, it's understandable that he's gone. That Moyes has gone back to Manchester United and he's pulled in three players who he obviously knows pretty well. So you hope that Moyes hasn't been scarred by his time at United and at in Spain. And if he can sort of do what he did at Everton, then I think most Sunderland fans would be pretty happy. I mean, I guess the battle is not to be in the relegation battle this season.
Yeah, hopefully not. And just moving on to your book, Angels with Dirty Faces, for those who don't know, it's a very comprehensive footballing history of Argentina. What made you want to write such a comprehensive book?
Well, I think there's two things. One is, and I don't want to sound sort of cynical with this, but you know, there's been books about pretty much every other major football nation and how the culture of a nation fits in with their football culture. And I first went to Argentina in 2007 when I was researching Inverting the Pyramid. And Buenos Aires is a city I just fell for immediately. You know, something about the faded grandeur of the place that really chimed with me. And so I kept going back and, you know, I met people there and you know, developed friendships there and did more and more work. I realised that this was a book that was waiting to be written. And I was, in some ways, slightly surprised that nobody's done it before and very grateful that I had the opportunity to do it because, as I say, it is something that I really responded to, that there's something within the Argentinian footballing character that I find fascinating.
And it is a very comprehensive history of Argentinian football. How long did it take from start to finish?
Yeah, no, those questions are always quite hard to answer. I mean, in terms of when, from getting the contract to actually sort of saying, okay, that's it, is probably around about 3 or 4 years. But in a sense, I was writing it from 2007, that as soon as I went there, I was aware that there were stories there and there was an overall sort of narrative that interested me. So, yeah, I mean, the answer could be anything between about 3 years and 9 years, but a long time anyway.
And which parts were sort of your favourite parts to write and to research?
There's obviously one of the things I wanted to do with the book, and one of the things I'm very glad my publishers allowed me to do, was that there's a certain stories you have to include. So obviously you have to include the two World Cup victories, and some of the details of what happened in 78 with the Hunter are extraordinary. Or you have to include Messi, you have to include Maradona. But actually what I wanted to do as well was to go into the stories that I'd never heard before and to sort of to build a narrative around that as well as the better-known story. So I think the research that was most intriguing, the research where it took a long time and a lot of work in a lot of different countries and where the breakthroughs you really thought nobody's ever realised this before, is the story of Imre Herschel. Now, he's not a big name, certainly in European terms, but he was the man who took European tactics to Argentina in 1982, and that's really the sort of second birth of Argentinian football. That's when they enter the modern world in terms of tactics. They've been very good before that. They got to the Olympic final in 1928, the World Cup final in 1930, but actually it's after he's gone there and taken the WM system that Herbert Chapman developed in England. Takes it over there and it develops, and that's where you get the great Argentinian sides of the late 40s and 50s. Mm. And he's an astonishing figure because everything that was known about him in Argentina turned out to be complete nonsense. That he'd always said, he played for the Ferenc Varos team that toured Argentina in 1929, and I just assumed that was true. And I went to Ferenc Varos and they said, we've never heard of this guy. And his story is extraordinary. It turns out that he basically was a bluffer. He'd been a semi-pro player in Hungary. He was Hungarian. And he ends up in São Paulo. And he meets up with Hakua, which was a Jewish team raising funds for Zionism. He meets up with them, gets a job with them as a masseur, and moves down as they tour down to Buenos Aires. He sort of puts himself about, lets himself be seen with the team. And it's off the back of that he gets his first job, which is at Gimnasia La Plata, who were not a big team at all. And there's one of the stories that's told, and it's very hard to know whether this is true or not, is that he was deliberately trying to get sacked to get the payoff, to get his wife and daughter over from Hungary. And you look at his results, and they only won three of his first 16 games in charge. He binned off loads of the star players, he started playing kids, he moved players out of position, and then suddenly everything clicks, and they start playing great football. And the following season, they probably would have won the title but got done by two really bad refereeing performances towards the end of the season. And so you then have this fascination of, was he deliberately trying to lose and suddenly hit upon something that worked, or was he a genius whose methods took time to settle in? And I don't think, you know, I couldn't adequately answer that. But that possibility, I think, is fascinating. And you dig a bit more into his past, and I was very fortunate, by complete chance, his daughter from his second marriage, who's in her mid-60s now, is a practicing psychoanalyst in Buenos Aires, got in touch with a friend of mine in Buenos Aires about something completely different. And just suddenly, I've met Herschel's daughter, and she's got all these newspaper articles, magazine articles about him, and her memories of her father. And from her memories, we worked out that he'd when he was 16, he'd lied about his age and signed up to fight in Palestine during the First World War under British command. So an absolutely fascinating man whose story just wasn't known before. So yeah, in terms of my favourite bit, the thing I think is actually the most valuable, is probably something that some people might skip over because he's not a big name. But I that's the kind of story that Argentina seems able to produce.
It certainly sounds like a fascinating story, that particular anecdote. The one part that stood out for me, sort of moving into the modern era, moving on to Lionel Messi, when you start talking about the drought that they've had over the last couple of decades, really. Are you surprised at the drought, the fact that there's not been a trophy for Argentina or Lionel Messi in this new era?
Yeah, I am. And I mean, in some ways, it's slightly freakish. You know, they've been in four finals. They've been a little bit unlucky. Two of those finals, they've lost on penalties. So it's not that, you know, they're turning up at tournaments and being terrible, or it's not they're not qualifying for tournaments. But I think it's a real concern for Argentinian football, because they had this great period when in seven under-20 World Cups, they won five of them between 1995 and 2005. And Messi, Aguero, Di Maria are right at the end of that. And so they win the Olympics in 2008, the three of them. And sort of the assumption was, oh yeah, this team will finally win something. And that team, you know, they're all 29, 30 now. And the fact they couldn't win the Copa America this year or last year, losing both of them in the final to Chile, both of them after normal draws, both of them on penalties, yeah, there's suddenly a recognition set in of, hang on, maybe we're not going to win this with that generation. And then they look at the next generation, and that's, obviously there's still good Argentinian players coming through, but they're not coming through in the same numbers. And so that's a major concern, that they haven't won anything since 1993. And if the next generation is not as good as the last generation or the one before that, how long is it going to be before they win anything ever again?
How long do you think it will be then, to put you on the spot, if it's not going to be this generation?
Well, I guess the dream is for them that the Messi generation wins the World Cup in 2018, or they got the Copa America in 2019 in Brazil. And I guess from an Argentinian point of view, going to the Maracanã, assuming the final is there, but going to Brazil and winning it in your great rival's backyard, or winning the World Cup in 2018, right at the end of that generation's life, I guess that is the glorious way of doing it. And you look at, the comparison is the Ivory Coast team, who, you know, they had that great generation. The Drogba was the start of it, but then the Touré brothers and Salomon Kalou and Gervinho, people like that, who everybody expected to win the African Cup of Nations. And it was actually immediately that everybody stopped expecting them to win it, though they do finally win it, by which time Drogba's retired. So you may get a situation like that, because I think there's an element of luck in international football, far, far more than there is in club football. But if they don't win it with this Messi generation, then, of course, they could do a Portugal, and they could just get a very solid team, and you know, Lamela could suddenly score five goals in a tournament, they could win something. But equally, it could be another 20, 30 years before they win something.
Mm. Now, looking at who Lionel Messi has basically succeeded in Diego Maradona, there's always going to be the comparisons between the two. Do you like to compare the two? Do you have a favourite?
I mean, I think the comparison is interesting if you have the comparison properly. I mean, you know, the sort of screeching on Twitter of, oh, he's obviously better, or he's obviously better. Neither of them is obviously better. They're both phenomenally gifted players. What you would say about Maradona is that he's won the World Cup, which obviously is a huge, huge thing in his favour. When it really, really mattered, he turned in three great performances in the quarterfinal, semi-final. And even though he was quieter in the final, the sort of way he and Lothar Matthäus cancelled each other out in 86 was significant. And you look at the three goals Argentina scored in that final. The first one is from a free kick for a foul of Maradona. The third goal, the winner after West Germany had come back into it to 2-2, it's Maradona's pass that sets Burisaga free to score. So he produced three great performances when it really mattered. what he did at Napoli. I mean, there's some Maradona apologists would go on about, oh yeah, Napoli were nothing and he made them great. Well, yeah, they hadn't won Serie A until he got there. But at the same time, they had just broken the world transfer record. They weren't nobodies. They had money. But what he did at Napoli was extraordinary. Messi's never been in a situation like that. You know, he's always played for Barcelona. I think he's been much more consistent through his career. He hasn't had the same lows as Maradona. I guess in narrative terms, which is what these things ultimately are judged on, Maradona's story was always overcoming his personal circumstances, his addictions, the terrible poverty of his background. Well, Messi's had none of that. But what he has got now is these obviously pretty deep-rooted doubts about his own usefulness to his country, his country's slightly cold relationship to him, which had begun to change in the last couple of years. But I suspect his retirement might sort of reawaken those doubts about him. But if he then can go on from those doubts to win the World Cup in 2018 or win the Copa America in 2019, then I guess he is also sort of seeing the darkness and overcome it. So, I would hate to say one is better than the other. What I would say is Messi has been way more consistent. Maradona's highs are probably slightly higher.
And there was just one other part of the book that struck me a little close to home when you've spoken about the German under-21 side that won the European Championships. The England team they beat in the final, both had their fairly different futures. Germany, I think something like six or seven?
I mean, six of them went on to win the World Cup.
Yeah, whereas
the England team went on to play for Sunderland.
Yeah, exactly. I thought, is that indicative of England's problem? Is that where England are going wrong? The fact that they don't bring the players through like Germany do. Germany bring players through to the under-21s, they then go on to the next level. England's don't. They don't kick on.
I mean, yeah, partly. And I think there is a problem in English football that, you know, even when we produce good players, they tend to get stockpiled by the big clubs. And you look at something like Daniel Sturridge. I mean, maybe this comparison isn't entirely fair. But by the time he was 23, I think when he played his 50th Premier League game, he was 23. And Lionel Messi, at the same age, already scored more than 200 goals in La Liga. So I think there is a problem. It's something like Daniel Sturridge should have played more than 50 games before the age of 23. So I think that is a problem. Having said that, these things aren't simple. One of the reasons that in Germany they can give kids more opportunities is that the league is not as competitive. That if you're Bayern Munich, you know that sort of 10, 15 games a season, you're going to stroll through. So you can afford to play 9 senior players and 2 younger players. And, you know, it's not really going to matter that much if one of the kids has a nightmare. That you're still probably going to win the game. Whereas the great beauty of the Premier League is that we have, well, this season, arguably 6 teams with a realistic chance of winning it. And that means that every point counts. So, you know, personally, I'd rather have a competitive league where, you know, we have no idea who's going to win it, rather than the situation in Germany where we're pretty certain Bayern Munich will win it, or in Italy where we're pretty certain Juve will win it, or even in Spain where, you know, we know it's one of 2 clubs. I think the strength of English football is we've got 6, arguably 7 if you count Leicester in there, who can win it, and that means our league football is more interesting. If that creates problems in terms of youth development and means that the national team is less competitive, that is a price that personally I'm willing to pay. But I mean, I'm aware that other people would see that differently.